the question?
What's the question? Lots of answers, but no question. Why don't we start a little bit by just reminiscing some of the things you talked about last night. As I understood last night, you did not go to a formal architecture school.
Oh, yeah.
How did you get into architecture as a, interest in the profession?
This may be interesting, actually, if you ask other people the same question. You know? Mm-hmm. You're right. Okay. I had my question yesterday, when I asked you, have you had a stable and sheltered life, is one question which I ask often people. Because without being able to change this kind of course of life in which I lived, I have been and had to survive incredible up and downs in my life. And this was started right from the beginning. I come from a very bourgeois provincial family, and in which we have been four children, two boys and two girls. Yeah? I had an older brother and an older sister, and then came I, and then there was still one other girl which came after me. So I was in my early childhood, and this is partially of the result of reports which people told me, my family told me, and relatives told me, and strange enough, personal memories. I have an extraordinary memory. And many people are amazed about it. For instance, when I can talk today with a student who was my student 25 years ago, and I can immediately restructure how he behaved and what happened between us, and so such a long time ago. So I was a very difficult child in my childhood, and I had the beginning was of course probably disturbed by the fact that I lost my father in this early age. When I was 5 years old, he had to go in the hospital and he never returned. Yeah? And as a result, when I went to school, I was an absolute failure in school. I could not follow. There is an incident in the age of 8 years old. This was about a year after my father's death. For instance, one day as my mother was out of town and an aunt of mine came to look for the family, for the children. And one day I said to her, today we have a holiday. I invented this, you know. I don't have to go to school. And she said, what holiday? And I couldn't tell her, you know. It turned out it was a day which I dreamed not to go to school. I had to develop from the very first day an extreme hate to schools because I could not accept any kind of authority. Because my father was dead, you know, there was nobody who could replace him, evidently. And this is my only explanation. And this went on to, when I'm like this, the first year, the second and the third year, or the 6 years, 7 years, 8 years old. We went through those early classes, and then the fourth year, I could not even reach the minimum level which entitles me to go into the next year. I had to stay 2 years in the same class, which is absolutely unusual. This actually is not known in the United States, you know. I think every child goes.
That sometimes is not true, but that,
okay. Yeah, okay. Okay. In my case, I had to stay 2 years in this class. And then in the fifth year, the same thing happened. I had again to stay 2 years in the class. I did not fulfill the basic requirements of an 11-year-old child. And so I came into the into the next class, which is now the sixth year, yeah? And there again it happened. I could not make it. Can you believe this? This is unbelievable. And now, in addition, I became older and older, which means the distance between a six-year-old child and the eight-year-old child is so great, you know. If an eight-year-old child has to sit in the class with a six-year-old, this is torture, you know, it's absolute insult. And evidently I was quite intelligent, you know, I felt myself so superior, not only to students, but to the teachers. I always saw them as idiots, yeah? Incapable to tell me anything, yeah? Which I didn't want to know in the first place. I never were, when my daughter, I always tell her that story. She is an honor student in her school. She graduated from junior high school to high school, in which 800 children graduated to go to high school, and she was one of 20 which became honor students. You know, she is now going in the honor class in high school. She said, if you only would do me a favor to bring me one bad grade, you know, at least one, as she used to tell her. I mean, you put me so ashamed, you know. And she always laughed about it. So. Oh, you poor thing, he says. And so at this moment, I was 12 years, I had the level of a 12-year-old, but I was already 14, you know. And then the principal of the school called my mother, the widow, and said to her, we have real problems with your boy, he has to sit again, and they make a proposition. If you take him out of school, because he has reached now the legal minimum level which the law requires, he can read and write. And if you want, he doesn't have to go to school anymore. Either you take him out, then I give him the degree to be ripe to go into the next year. And or he has to sit one other year. So my mother took me out, and this is what I wanted. You know? And I was free. And then I became, so in this family, what chances do you have? The son, if he's intelligent, he studies, or if he is clever, then he becomes a businessman, he wants to become a businessman or something like this. But in my case, it was different. As a very small child, I have known already what I wanted to be. I wanted to build things. This was always absolutely clear in my life. There was never a question about it. And but I didn't know what to build, so the nearest thing was furniture. I wanted to make furniture. I was pretty good as a craftsman. I made repairs at home and so on. And I played with my brother, who was 5 years older than I am. We used to play with tin soldiers, you know, battles and so on. And I built the castles, yeah, and he had a little cannon with peas and destroyed them, yeah. And we have been, I have been that kind of phenomenon that I never cried when he destroyed what I built, but I was happy that I could rebuild it and change it and so on. So this was the initial sign, but I may be. So I became a carpenter, no, cabinet maker. This was, of course, basically the shame of the family. It was something which one whispered only about, you know, this boy, he didn't make it. He will have trouble in his life, you know, and so on. So I became a cabinet maker, and I enjoyed this tremendously. And I was an apprentice for 4 years, and then I became a journeyman. And then I was so involved. In the meantime, I learned a little bit more and had wild ideas. Then I became a carpenter. And so roof structures and staircases and things like this. So I worked 7 years in this trade. And when I was 2 years old, I was a perfect craftsman, like any other skilled journeyman in cabinet making and carpentry. And in this provincial town, of course, we had to do all kinds of work, so I learned also bricklaying, you know, some many instances. You have to build your own walls on which you put your roofing on top. So then I had an aunt, and she was a woman. She loved me, and she sensed that my future is not that bad, that I will not end up in prison, you know. And she said, you have to, I go to Berlin. I'm born in the city, Frankfurt an der Oder, this is Eastern Germany, and about 80 kilometers from Berlin, this, or 60 kilometers, I don't know. They're very, very close. And then I came to Metropolis, and there was a man, I don't know how familiar you are with him, is the name Bruno Paul?
No, I don't know.
Bruno Paul was an important man. He was, for instance, the teacher of Mies van der Rohe, was one of his students. And, or not really his student, Mies van der Rohe worked for him in his office. Mies van der Rohe had a very similar educational background. He never went to school, you know. He is also only the public school, and that was the end of it. And he was a stonemason. His father made tombstones, yeah, for cemeteries. Yeah. And so I came to Berlin to that school there. And this is a very difficult thing. You see a provincial boy who has many people hammered in him the need for having a bad conscience, which I really didn't have, and that I became a failure. And so I had a real tough problem now, be confronted with those city boys, you know, which other students there at the school. Which actually, there's one little detail which I may quickly mention. To go, to be accepted at the School for Applied Art, the German word is Kunstgewerbeschule, yeah. School of Applied Art, Berlin. I had to pass an examination, the entrance examination, which was an examination which took 3 days, I believe, yeah, 3 or 4 days, almost a week. And what they tested you were, for instance, they showed the Persian carpet, and for 5 minutes, and then you have to, by memory, redesign the pattern, which of course I couldn't, you know. And then the next one was life drawings, yeah? And I saw for the first time in my life a naked woman in a spotlight, yeah? Sitting in the middle of the room, surrounded by boys and girls, yeah? And you looked at them, and they made drawings, and my hand trembled. I couldn't. It was absolute nothing, you know? So I realized this is the next failure, you know? And then came the next thing was the design of a piece of furniture. The sideboard, you know, that buffet in the dining room at this time was the style of the time. And I designed the sideboard, but I designed it with all sections, vertical and horizontal, and with a precise description how every part, how a drawer is made, and with the joint on the corner, you know, and the sliding devices And this was so perfect, it became a sensation. The director, the Bruno Paul, came, the teacher showed him this. He has never seen anything like this, you know, by a student. And so I was immediately accepted. And this was the moment which changed everything. In the course of events, I then spent 1.5 years at the school, and I was so incredibly hurt by the immorality and the phoniness of that school, you know, the phoniness of those other students, the banality of the teachers, without knowing anything, but I sensed all those things, you know, I said, I couldn't stay here. I couldn't live here. And I went with a friend of mine who I got acquainted with. He was a painter. He went to Dresden. I said, what is Dresden, you know? And they said, there's an academy, and why don't you come, we go together. And we went. And there was a man, his name was Heinrich Tessenow. Is this name familiar to you?
No.
Tessenow? T-E-N-E-S-S-O-W. It's a very important man in the German history of
architecture. In Dresden?
What?
In Dresden.
In Dresden. He was here. He built this famous... I wish you should try to look a little bit for this name, you know.
Bruno Paul's school was in Berlin.
The Bruno Paul school was Berlin, yeah. And so I went to Dresden. And he immediately accepted me because he himself was a carpenter originally. Like all those people, you know, in the beginning of the 20th century, none of them was. Syncropius was actually the only one who had a formal education. He studied architecture, graduated, and made all the examination and had an architecture license and so on. And then I lived there, and then something else happened, the inflation, the German inflation. So when you are talking here about inflation, this is of course child's play. Yeah, this is nothing. I can tell you, for instance, that one day when I bought a loaf of bread, a piece of loaf of bread is in Germany, it's about this, same size like here, yeah, one piece. And to buy this, I wrapped the newspaper, the money to buy it, put it in a package which was bigger than the many millions of marks, consisting of 1,000 mark notes and 10,000 mark notes. This is very unreal, hard to describe. So I starved myself to death because I had also in my family, I'm connected with a very wealthy family, relatives. The, for instance, the IG Farben, which is the German DuPont. You know, they have been uncles of mine, so the vice presidents of, and so on, and all kinds of people. And they gave me a grant to study, which was, I think, at this time, 200 marks, which was enough to study, which would be, if somebody would have today, $200 or $300 for a student, this is enough, yeah? And but this dwindled away to become two pennies or had no value whatsoever. So I had to give it up. And I went to Berlin, returned to Berlin. It was a question to either to die or to escape. Yeah? And I went to Berlin and I looked for, I actually wanted to go home to my mother, which I hated to do. I loved her very much, but I couldn't stay at home. You know, this was impossible. My brother was actually, he was already killed in the war, you know, in the First World War. He was a soldier in the war, immediately shot at the age of 19 already, something like this. And so I could not live with three women and all the aunts around there and the friends of my mother. This was impossible. So I went to Berlin and looked for a job and found in the telephone directory some name of an architect and went to him. And it immediately got this job because my chance was, of course, I could draw details. It's very interesting because later in my life, this detail played such an important part, you know. And so I was staying in this office of a commercial conventional, so he claimed to be a modern architect, of course he wasn't, yeah. So But I had already, I sensed already the bulges, you know. I said, this is meaningful. So I spent there 9 months, and then I quit. Just quit. This was the only job I ever had in my life. Then I was 20, 21. Then I learned making a drawing. I learned it by myself, you know, at those schools where it was at least a drafting board, which I never had, and they did supply T-squares, you know. So I learned to sharpen a pencil and make lines, and since I know what precise information is for a craftsman who likes to be told exactly what he has to do, so I made those drawings right from the beginning. And then I left that place and I lived this kind of coffee house life. I make some reference in this article, yeah.
But yes, I remember that.
This was absolutely fantastic for me. This was the real information. This have been my richest years, you know, and then from then on became turmoil. So first of all, there was Pölzig, yeah. Somebody who has known me said, you know, I know a man who will hire you immediately. This is Pölzig. He was very famous at this time, and I went to him, and he hired me immediately. And he was a professor of the Academy of Art in Berlin also, and so as such he had the government gave him this is a customary in Germany, you know, the government gives those men a fabulous apartment, yeah, and in this case it was in the palace of the Prussian kings in Sanssouci in Potsdam, yeah.
In Potsdam.
This, and so I suddenly saw myself living in this incredible, in this environment, and I was staying there where the German princess used to live, you know, this was my bedroom now, you see, and this was an incredible beginning. But if you know Pölzig, he was probably the only man which I recognized. Yeah. The first man in my life, I was already almost 22, I believe, at this time, who I think was an incredible personality and a lousy architect. That happened to him. And he had this Baroque type of dramatic architecture. You may know this project, for instance, for Salzburg, the festival hall, the opera house. Yeah, so. And so I went to him, and there again it happened. I couldn't stand it. I couldn't. And I did not know why, except I had to reject it. This is not my world, it's not my dream of architecture. And then came something else, which is very...
How long were you with Pölzig?
Very short time, about less than a year. Less than a year. Again, I was 9, 10 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him so. He was a man you can tell him. He said, I cannot stay here. I don't belong here. He said, yes, you may be right. But there was something else. I was never happy in Germany. I'm born with some sort of this was my Heimat, yeah, my homeland. Yeah. And I had a deep anti-German feelings. Yeah. I felt I cannot communicate here, and I cannot live here. And I decided I go away from Germany. And now then I was in a very romantic stage, you know, in this early years, and I said I'm leaving Germany and I'm going around the world, and I may come back as a very old man, which wasn't my time, or the old Tsar sage, yeah, sage, you know, in the age of 50, you know, then I will live the rest of my life in my hometown, and this was it. So I did. I went, Pölzig gave me two recommendations. He said, there is a man in Holland, I think he may be the man you are really looking for. His name was Oud, yeah? Oud, yeah?
Yes.
You know him. So I went to out and he laughed and said, you know, I would like you to be here, but I have no work whatsoever. In fact, if you have something for me, I would be glad to work for you. I was 22, he was about, how old was he? 40, I think. So. And in addition, this was now, I want to make this clear, after the war, you know, this was 1920, 22. It was a time in which no country could, there was no prosperity in Europe. Yeah? Everything collapsed. And it was illegal for a foreigner to go to Holland, for instance, to look for a job, you know, which was absolutely legal. So I didn't care, didn't know. The police came and asked me, what are you doing here? And I had no money. I lived in the Salvation Army, in the attic of some incredible environment. And they arrested me, put me in jail for a few weeks, and then they escorted me to the border, pushed me over the border, and then I'm back in Germany. Now, I couldn't go back to Berlin, you know, this would be the greatest defeat because I said goodbye to everyone. And so I had my pride, and then I left, and there is a, this is too long a story, also not material. And anyway, I found somebody who gave me 50 marks, which was a lot of money at this time, and I decided to go to Paris. Because in Paris was a young man who was very well known in Germany already. Not completely unknown in France. This was Charles Le Corbusier, yeah? Jean Hiret. And that's the man I would like to try. And I went to Paris. And that's the day in which I arrived in Paris, the French franc collapsed. And for those $20 or $30 which I still have left, came my ticket and so on. It's 30 marks which I had left. I got an enormous amount of francs in exchange. And I felt almost rich. And I went to Corbusier, and no, this took a few weeks before I think he was not there or some this, I don't remember. And I went to him and I said, my name is Conor Maxwell, I'm looking for a job. Can I work in your office? And he was sitting with me and had a long interview, and at the end of the interview he said, you know, I like to take you in, you can work here. And I was beaming, yeah? And he said, and you don't have to pay me anything. I said, well, what do you mean by pay me anything? Well, he said, I have no work. I am a my employees are my students. I'm teaching them, and therefore they have to pay me. Don't you see this? Yes, I said this. I can see this, but I have to live. I have nothing whatsoever to live. And so he said, I'm terribly sorry. So the whole thing evaporated in nothing, and he gave me about maybe 10 or 20 francs, you know, and said, I can't help you. So this was the end of my experience with Corbusier. Again, I was pushed on the street. And the only chance I had to survive was, but everybody did at this time, I became a newspaper boy who I sold on the Boulevard Saint-Michel Quotidien, which was a French newspaper at this time, and tried to make my living. But this was a lousy life, and you couldn't live on this. It was enough, I could enough sell enough papers to buy two sandwiches. You know, this is those long French bread, slices, and there's a piece of ham in between, dry, that you eat. And I was sleeping in the Gare Montparnasse, you know, this railroad station,
yes. Mm-hmm.
In the window sills, you know, like the clochards living. And so I lived there a while, and it was horrible. And besides, I didn't know what to do. You know, I get panic in a big town, yeah? And there have been two other people which I approached, one was, what is the name of this French architect? He died relative young, I forgot right now, but I will remember this name. And I...
Cornier?
Not Cornier, Malestevance. Mm-hmm. Malestevance, yeah? Mm-hmm. Very important. And he was very nice. He let me work for a week whenever he had money, you know. Then he gave me a few francs and so on. In Corbusier actually did something which I have forgotten to tell you because this 50 years later became important. He said, you must be a good draftsman. I tell you what, would you like to make a drawing for me? I said, surely, of course. And he gave me a floor plan of a building which consists only of columns, yeah, and the outside contour, but nothing in it, not even stairs, the staircases, I believe, have been indicated. And I made him a perfect drawing of this particular building. This was his first project, which he did for the Soviet Union in Moscow. He built this...
The Ministry of Health?
This was it not Ministry of Health, it was a union for some union administration building. You know this building which...
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is not health, became very well known. I made one drawing for him. I said, it's perfect and you can stay with us and you don't have to pay me. So I have been defeated, of course, and then I had a sister in Germany, I loved very, very much, and she sent me a railroad ticket to come back to Germany because she realized if she would send me money, I would never come back. So I returned to Germany, clandestinely, not telling anybody, no, hoping that I can survive in Germany, which I really didn't want. But I returned to Berlin, lived in the room with a friend of mine, whom I asked, don't tell anybody that I am here, and I never went to this café, this Romanische café, which I mentioned in this article, but this boy, of course, he talked. And one day, the door opens about 5-6 days after I was there, somebody knocked the door, I opened the door, and there was Pölzig himself, you know, who has known me, of course, well enough, realizing I would never go to him, you know. He came and said, and he had a very folksy art to talk, you know, son of a bitch, you know. Here I put the envelope on the table, said, take this, and do exactly what I say in this letter, and walked out and slammed the door. So I opened it, inside was a 10 marks bill, and a railroad ticket to go to provincial, to a village, not a town, a village, only, I think, 1,500 people there. And in Silesia, with a precise description, you go there and talk to this man, and said, I sent you there, and you get a job there. So, and there you, this is what he said, try to drink as much as possible milk and eat as much as possible. They have enough food there, and butter and bread and meat, and this is what you need. I was probably, I weighed 90 pounds or something like this. And I did, because I had no other choices. I couldn't sell this railroad ticket. What can you do? So I went there. And this place was an incredible place. It was a village which I touched outside the village, was a big factory. This happened sometimes. It happened in America too, you know, big industries in a very remote place because they have labor supply there and space and so on. And this was a factory which made prefabricated houses. And they had an industry there, which I didn't know that houses can be built with in industrial plants, you know, houses are with contractors' jobs. So. And they built wooden barracks for hospitals, schools, painting cottages, things like this, you know, everything that you can make from wood. And I was there, and this was like a bombshell. There, for the first time, I saw machines. Yeah. And I realized, remembering how I suffered to with my planer or with the saw, everything by hand, and there everything must be made by machines. So I was in this place 3.5 years. I was, I arrived there, and I think 4 months later I was chief architect. I had about 20 draftsmen and architects and designers and all kinds of people under my control, and have never learned to do it, didn't know what to do. But I remember only this was a fantastic time. I worked there day and night, and I built many buildings. This was easy because in Germany at this time, you didn't have to have a license, you know, nobody had a license. If you want to be architect, you call yourself architect, and that's it. And so I worked there many years, and the jobs became more and more interesting as much as I progressed. And this factory built not only prefabricated houses, they also built steel, and they built bridges, and streetcars, and all kinds of things, even engines they made. They had about people, I think the employees have been 3,000 people. They came from all villages around on bicycles every morning in the factory, it was the absolute fantastic place. And only a man like Pölzig, who hasn't really known me, has known me better than I could possibly know myself, he sensed that is a place for that boy, you know. And his speculation was right. And from this day on, this kind of new active life began. Now I was 24, 25, 26 years old. I think in the age of 27, I quit the company at a time which I had probably reached the absolute climax which anybody can dream of. I was, I could do anything I wanted to do. I had the confidence of the presidents and the chairman of the board and everybody. And I had success. I made every drawing I made was sold, you know, as it really built. And this was a good time, and ended actually with, you may have heard about this, step come. One day I built a house for Albert Einstein, yeah? Did I tell you this? This Albert Einstein, so let me quickly, you have to actually to tell me how many minutes, you have to stop me when I go too much in detail.
Yeah.
But it's important to understand it, yeah? For instance, one day I was reading in the newspaper that the famous scientist, Professor Albert Einstein, will have his 50th birthday next year, in the city of Berlin, want to make him a present and want to give him a house to live in. He has never had a house. He lived in an apartment in Berlin, in a rather small apartment. And then one sentence was there attached to that, and it is known that Professor Einstein would like to have a house built from wood because he likes wood so much. When I read this sentence, then I said to myself, the only man in the world who can build his house is am I, because there is nobody in the world who knows so much about timber. You know, I was not only a craftsman, but I worked 3 years in the wood factory, and so who else could know so much about it? So I saw this note early in the morning, and I rushed to the local railroad station, which was far out in the countryside. It was a little building, you know, so big. And there came the train and stopped. I go in the train, then go in the next city, and then change the train and go into the big train, and then I go to Berlin, which took about 3 or 4 hours. And then I arrived in Berlin and I looked the telephone book and I saw it was Albert Einstein. Haberlandstraße 12. This was the Haberland Street number 12. But we had, my company had in Berlin, of course, a sales office. And I had gave instruction to somebody when I rushed out, I had no time to call them. It was also too early. Said, call this office in Berlin when it opens at 9 o'clock. They should send a car with a chauffeur to the railroad station, wait for me. And I always explain this, the climax of the power of a young man who can call. Some office said, send me a car with chauffeur to the railroad station to pick me up. And with this car, I went to this house and I rang the bell and the maid opened and said, I would like to talk to Professor Einstein. I said, what's your name? What time do you have your appointment here? I said, I have no appointment. Well, she said, Professor Einstein doesn't see anybody who doesn't have an appointment. So at this moment, Mrs. Einstein appeared. What's going on and what do you want? She said. And I said, I would like to build the house from Professor Einstein. Can you believe this? The naivety of a young man staying there and said, good morning, I want to build your house, yeah? But it worked. She said, who are you? I said, my name is Konrad Wachsmann. I said, I don't want you to bother you, only I want to ask 3 questions. Can I see the property? Can you tell me where this place is? And where the house shall be built? And how big is your family? And I will do the rest. And she said, you cannot see this property because this is not in Berlin, this is far out. I said, well, I have a car here downstairs. What? She said, you have a car? Yes. I said, please, can I show it to you? And at this moment, all this conversation was in the staircase, you know. And now I was inside and this maid closed the door and I was with Mrs. Einstein alone in her apartment. We walked to the living room, to the window, and said, this is my car. And suddenly she switched and she thought, I haven't seen the property myself. Are you going there now? Can you take me with you? Surely, I said. And the next minute, she was sitting in the car, and I was, I think, very well, I had my very special way to seduce her in the car and to persuade her to accept me as a reliable person, and she could trust her. And so we saw the property, we returned. I've known her whole life story, and I've known Einstein's life story. I've heard the story about his snoring, you know, his terrible snoring in the night. He has to be far isolated, nobody can stay with him because he has a tremendous problem with snoring, yeah, and I returned happily. I said goodbye to her, and I had the feelings she wanted to see me again. And really, she said, in the last minute, she said, "Would you like to meet Albert?" Yeah, this is Einstein. Oh, yes, I said, well, tell him the story which you told me tomorrow. Would you like to come for dinner? Yeah. So I said, I will be tomorrow evening for dinner. Then it was about, let me see, 4 o'clock, something like this, I don't know. I know the train connections, you know. I immediately said to the driver, get me back to the railroad station. I said to him, call my office in Niesky, that's the name of this village, and tell the people I want to have all my men there next morning at 7 o'clock instead of 8 o'clock in the morning. I started to make sketches in the train. I went to the office in the same night. I arrived there about midnight. I I worked the whole night and have everything, plans, section, floor plans, elevations, and renderings and so, details and so. Everything was essentially ready. And the next morning at 7 o'clock, he said, you do this, you do this, you do this, you do this. The estimator did estimating, the engineer did the stress analysis of very long beams, you know, the FPM.